This is John Erickson from AdvancedBallStriking.com. I recently was able to get back in touch with an old touring pro friend of mine, Paul Henrich, who is the son of one of the great Canadian players that played on the PGA Tour, played a lot of golf against Mo Norman head-to-head, George Knutson, Al Balding, Alvie Thompson, and all the other great Canadian players through the 1950s and 60s. Paul was kind enough to arrange an interview with his father, John Henrich. So we're going to get things started here. I've got on the phone Paul Henrich and John Henrich, and we're going to go ahead and talk a little golf.
We just came in from our session.
Okay, so we've got the old pro with us today, right?
The old pro is hanging out right here with me. Just come in from outside. We're hitting some balls. It's a beautiful day.
Yeah, well, it's cold and raining here in San Francisco.
We got you beat here in northern part of the world. Toronto's, what have we got today, pro? About 60?
Okay.
About 60, 62. Bright sunshine and very little wind. So we just had a hoot, and I tried to do some, I only got like a digital camera, but we were hitting some balls and laughing and talking about equipment, forged irons. And I'm going to put you on to Dad.
Okay, great. Thanks, Paul.
All right, John. Bye.
John Erickson, this is another John.
Yeah, hi, John. I met you in, I believe, maybe early 90s. I played in the Tournament Players Championship at Brampton, your course there.
Right on. 89, 90?
Yeah, somewhere, I think when Jerry Anderson won it that year.
Right on.
Yeah, Jerry was a fine player. That was fun to watch.
How are you doing?
Yes, I've been good, thanks. I've been teaching golf. We've got a nice little website, advancedballstriking.com. Paul's been kind enough to visit there and post some of his thoughts on the game. And I prefer teaching from a more traditional standpoint, because most people play on golf courses that are old school, you know, more than the 7,500-yard golf courses that we're seeing out on the tour today.
Right on.
So based upon that a lot of people are still playing 6,500-yard courses, 6,800 yards, and they're tight, I want my students hitting the ball straight, and I'm a bit leery of the modern gear, the super lightweight long clubs, you know, putting those in the hands of my students, and I'm not sure it's necessarily the right type of gear for the old style courses.
You're on the right track, by the way. Take the driver out of their hands, they've got a chance.
Yeah, and so one of the, well, I've got a lot of questions for you, but of course the first thing would be, I'd love to hear a little bit about, or have you talk about some of your accomplishments as a player, just for my students and our website forum to understand who they're talking to. I know not everyone's familiar with a lot of the...
John, I don't have any super things in my resume other than I won the Quebec Open back in 67. I first played the Canadian Open in 1950. I thought I was going to win, you know, being a brash 20-year-old, and played with Tommy Cruickshank and Kyle Affoon, and had a wonderful time, except that I went home and I was a little upset because I shot 72, 73, you know, and I played again the following year and didn't do any better, but I wanted to play, and then things changed. So I was on the 1958 Carling Cup team. That was Canada versus United States. We played it for the Carling Cup at St. George's in Toronto, and we happened to get lucky and win that day. So it was a four amateur, four pro team. There was our Canadian team was Stan Leonard, Al Balding, Jack Kay, and myself. So that's a little bit of the background. And then I played the tour, the winter part of the tour, from 53 to 62.
That was the PGA Tour, right?
I played the PGA Tour, yeah.
Right, right. Now, back in the old days, all, you know, pretty much most of the guys had club pro jobs, even the big names like Sam Snead, and, you know, everybody went home and had a club pro job, right?
They did that, yeah. Like, it wasn't a full tour. There was we had a lot of club pros playing in the 50s. Snead may never have worked, but he was always attached to a club. Even Hogan was attached to a club. Yeah, a lot of guys, they played sporadically. They didn't play 50 weeks of the year. It evolved. It went from being a good club pro that played tournaments to a tour. You know, the tour originally was run by the PGA of America, and then they split a little bit, and the tour went on their own.
Now, John, I know you had quite an accomplished career as a senior tour player, including the Canadian Senior Open.
I may have been second a couple of times.
Oh, okay. You finished.
I was going to win at Brampton in 1982 or something, but I made bogey in the last hole, and Mo Norman made birdie, and so he won, and I was a shot behind him.
And the Ontario Seniors.
I won three Ontario Seniors.
Wow, that's really great. Yeah, speaking of Mo, I got to see Mo, kind of towards the end of his, his career. I mean, he played a couple events, and I was playing. I played 1987. Mo was kind of done with his competitive golf, I think. But, a great ball striker, a great range player, and certainly a great showman.
Yeah.
Do you have any thoughts on Mo? One question I have is, do you feel Mo is deserving of the legacy that he has as being, one of the great all-time strikers? Because I know there were a lot of great ball strikers back then.
John, that's a tough question. I think that Mo, in all seriousness, was a great ball striker, maybe not as good a player as a lot of other players, but a good ball striker. It's confusing as to how his legacy is going to come out. But we think that he was pretty good. I happened to run into Mo and George Newton at the same time, and it was match play, and they were playing Marklin Woods here in Toronto. And Mo turned to me and says, "No, I can't beat him."
Yeah. Now George was obviously the more accomplished player. I'm a huge George Knutson fan, as my students know. I love his golf swing. I think. He really. I don't know if you're familiar with Al Barkow, the golf writer.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, Al's a good friend of mine. We play golf every week together here in San Francisco. Yeah, and Al said that George was the most Hogan-like of any of the strikers of his era.
Yes, he was. I played a lot of rounds with George, and he was that good. I don't know whether you're familiar with Mississauga Golf Club. Okay, the 12th hole is called the Big Chief, and it's got a raised green going over a creek or a river. I'm in the last group with George and Albie Thompson. I don't know, it's 64 or 68 or 70, whatever the year, I'm not sure. Anyway, my ball is past theirs off the tee, and it's a layup for me. Well, now George is behind me, and he hits before, and he reaches the green in two. Like, he flies at 250 yards in the air and over the creek to a raised and elevated green. Just a marvelous shot. George didn't win that week. Albie did, but George had the shots, and possibly the best ball striker in Canada. I played with both Al Balding and George at the same time one day, and they were having a go at it, and I was refereeing, I guess, in a sense. Both of them were good friends of mine. And I like what George said. He turned around, so Al says, "Well, you've got to keep, your head still." And George says, "Oh, the hell, Al, you don't have to keep your head still. It moves. It moves with the swing." So, John, I was there, and I played with him, and I practiced with him. We played the Canadian PGA in Vancouver one year, and it was the early stages of when they allowed some of the probationary or new members of the PGA to play in the PGA Championship. It was the first go for young pros in Canada to play in the championship. George and I show up on the practice field every morning prior to the first round, stay at the same hotel, go out, and none of these young kids came out to watch George, and I was shocked and surprised that no one would come out to watch George. Here is the best ball striker, he's once on the tour, and none of these new pros, I guess they're too busy doing chasing. And George and I had the practice field to ourselves. He says, "John, look at this, here's what I just picked up in the last couple of weeks." Now, we're playing off the practice range, and it's like a putting green. there's no grass to it. It's flat. He's got a driver in his hand, and he's airmailing it right off the turf. He says, I can do this left to right, right to left, you know. And he says, I use it a lot now. He was the best ball striker that I played with. I've never played with Hogan, but I have played with someone that Hogan liked, and that was Tommy Bolt. Tommy Bolt, in my eyes, was the best ball striker. Tita Green and George was right there with him. So there you go.
Well, that's great. I'm curious about, you know, how did you guys used to set up your gear back then? I know, you know, there's been a big paradigm shift. You know, everybody's going to lightweight gear. But back then, you know, I've heard stories that Mo and George were swinging 16-ounce drivers and stuff like that.
So in general, John, what are your thoughts on the old-style gear?
Our PGA in 2005 had a reunion at Royal Ottawa in Ottawa in 2005. And we came to the fifth hole, and we had a little scramble going. Team of four playing scramble. We got to the sixth hole. It's 155 yards. The deal on the tee is you had to use what they had. There were two old pros that were playing, but they had the cold beer ready for us. Yeah, we were the young guys. We were 75, and these old pros had mashies and niblicks and what have you, and a couple of mid-irons. So 155 yards. You teed the ball up with wet sand and hit one of their clubs. Now, I hit a mashie, hit it about 15 feet short of the hole, John. The sensation and feel was better than my TaylorMade. So there.
Interesting. How did...
It really felt really good. No practice swing, just the bloody, you know, up to the ball, hit it, and the flight was great. The sensation and feedback was marvelous.
When you were playing in your prime, do you remember how you set your clubs up? Were you setting them up, you know, butt weighting and the clubs, putting lead tape under the grips and that sort of thing?
I put lead tape under the grip after I heard Hogan did it. I didn't do it early. It was late. It was in the 70s when I did that.
So they were trying to put more weight in the head of the club, and then to get the swing weight back to something lower in the Ds, D5, D4, something like that, then they would butt weight the clubs, right?
Yeah.
So would you say when you guys were setting up your gear, it was a lot more about the feel and the aesthetic of the club?
As long as it felt right to you and it looked right, then that was okay?
It has to look good. It has to have eye appeal.
Yeah. That's something that's really been lost, hasn't it?
Of course it has.
Yeah.
Too much engineering in the game. Paul ran through my basement the other day. He pulled out a Sir Walter Two Wood. Now, it's a Hagen Two Wood, and that's got to be from the 40s, late 40s or early 50s, and I'm not sure that. And he's hitting the goddamn ball like magic with this club, and it's got a soft shaft in it. And this small, shallow-headed two-wood, and he fell in love with it. And he can work the ball either both ways. Now, there's a club that wasn't made for anybody but the public. Laminated head and all. Oh, yeah, it's a bore through the shaft as well. Yeah, and a nice little play, but the face of the club is such that you can move the ball both ways, up and down, left and right, and it's just amazing. And I've always said that you can't do that with metal wood, because there's no give to the metal, and the ball comes off the face too soon.
How you swung pretty flat irons, didn't you?
I flattened the iron out a little bit, maybe by a couple of degrees.
But you had your irons a little bit flat. It looked like George swung pretty flat. He must have had pretty flat irons.
You know, he sat down to the ball a little bit early on. I think maybe later in his days, I got a picture of George at home. Maybe later in his day, he stood up a little bit. When you say that you're teaching and you've got students, John?
Yeah.
Okay, I think you're on the right track with golf equipment and golf swing-wise. I pulled out an old Bobby Jones thing this morning, and was going to get Paul to take a look at it. And looking at the players at Augusta on the weekend and looking at some of the players that I played with, their posture and position is altogether out of whack with what it used to be. They're standing so tall today, they don't look as though they can move the right way. The flex isn't there, the bend isn't there, there isn't a bend into the ball. You know, that athletic position doesn't seem to be there. When you're looking at teaching, I think you've got to look at where the swing originated and where it went. Now, these kids today, they started playing golf. This is my humble opinion. They started playing golf as too young and were standing tall and never changed their position. They just kept standing tall and no bend into the shot.
When you
go back in history, the hands were a lot lower. I've got an old Billy Burke 9-iron in my bag of tricks at home, and it's so much flatter, and it wasn't made for anybody. It's so much flatter in its lie. It's a marvelous looking golf club. It just sits perfectly. Today, I think they're standing too tall.
I know George, you know, had a lot of bend, and Hogan apparently, from what I understand, was playing off irons that were 8 degrees flat.
You know more about that than I didn't study that. You know, I happened to walk around, watch Hogan play one day, and that's about all I did. And
That was in 1951. You said
isn't that something? Yeah.
Yeah,
we slept on Magnolia Lane because we didn't have enough money to get home.
So in 1951, you went to the Masters and you watched Ben Hogan play. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, we watched Hogan play. He made one bogey and three birdies. One was a kind of a flukish birdie. Here's one. He hit his 2-iron off the fourth hole, the par three. The ball landed by the hole, bounced forward, and then bounced again, and went 20 feet past the hole. Walking off the tee, his 2-iron is now embedded in the goddamn tee. I mean, he just jammed it right in the tee. And nearly did the same thing on 5, just threw the club at the caddy. He hit that mound. He needed another 3 or 4 feet of carry to get over that first little mound in the approach to the fifth green. And he's at the bottom of the green, but the guy's had a smile on his face after he hit his putt because it went in the bloody hole. You know, from a three-putter, from a three-putt distance, he put it in the hole. And they played twosomes the first day, and it was just marvelous. I think he played with Schwanahan. And I went all the way, and his last birdie was on the... He didn't make anything other than that lucky thing on... And a short birdie putt on 18. He had a drive and a 6-iron back then. It was just arrowed. He hit arrows all day.
It was pretty impressive, huh?
Very impressive. Like his fade, or his not hooking the ball, or his fading the ball. His fading the ball, when you hit it hard enough, it goes pretty damn straight. He just took the hook out of the equation. But he could draw the ball at will when he needed to.
People say it had a different sound when he hit it. Do you remember that?
Yeah, it did. I watched him on the range, too, before he went to play.
And the sound of the strike was different than what other people were doing.
Yeah, it was. I can't describe it, but it was. It sounded different.
Yeah, I've heard that too.
Yeah, and I can't describe it. It's too long ago in history, but I watched him. I caught him when he was hitting 8 irons and finishing his practice session, and the thing that struck me was. So machine-like, it wasn't anything missing in the motion, you know, like it was just automatic as though it was machine. Now, this is after an accident, of course.
Right.
So he came back pretty damn good. I liked the way he did it. His transition, of course, was marvelous. It was new, kind of different. I've got guys that I like. I like Hogan, but I would be a fan of Bobby Jones as well. You know, if you're looking at teaching.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we look at a lot of the different, you know, great swings. I don't necessarily have a real specific method that I teach, but I try and look at, you know, the similarities between a lot of the great ball strikers and yeah. how we can, you know, work that. But it certainly is quite different than what we're seeing in, like you said, in the golf swings today.
Yeah. Well, I've been, for the last 10 years, I've been looking at it, and I said, well, you know, you can't teach dubs to play like the pros. And I'm trying to I'm looking at it, you know, really digging hard to figure out how the hell are we missing? There's got to be another way of teaching people that aren't athletic. They get off the couch and they want to go to play golf. They want to join the club, but they're unathletic, not fit, and have not a whole lot of coordination. I think we start them the wrong way. I say that we should start them swinging the club back with the other side as opposed to the left side. Yeah, I think it's a mistake. I think this, you can teach little juniors and athletes to play backwards. The golf swing's backwards. Don't you believe that, John?
Yeah, well, I certainly teach more from impact to the finish. I spend a lot of time, because I really want students to be accelerating the club through the ball.
Well, you got to take, when you want to accelerate, you've got to have that forward side moving. If it's not moving, you can't accelerate.
Yeah, that's right.
You know, and Eddie Marins is right when he came up and said, swing the handle. You're going to use the left side on the way down. You better use the right side going back. I got three guys that I say, Hogan, Kenny Perry, and Harry Vardon, said you can't swing the golf club with a stiff left arm. Hogan's left arm may have been straight, but Jackie Burke was, when they asked people, what is Hogan's secret? My impression of Jackie Burke as one of the better ball strikers and knowledgeable people in golf I got a high regard for Jackie Burke. I watched him before I started play on the tour, and he came up with something. He said Hogan got to the same spot in the backswing every time, and I don't think you can do that with your left arm.
Bill Melhorn had a bent left arm.
So did Harry Vardon.
Yeah, yeah, I agree. I think there's some validity to that.
I'm going to try and get that started here with some people. I'm not teaching anymore, but I'm going to get that idea to get some momentum, because after, you know, I started teaching in 1950, and here I am, you know, having some sleepless nights saying, hey, why can't I teach that guy? You know, I know how to swing. I can't teach him to do something he can't do. So you might as well get him comfortable, take the glove off their hand, use 10 fingers, and get the right side going back as opposed to the left side.
Paul told me you've got a nice story for me about the 1967 Quebec Open and what happened to Mo on the second or third green.
Yeah, it was about the third green. It's short par four, I think. Anyway, when Mo wasn't in his comfort zone, he kind of sulked a little bit. Where we played that year, that was Arvida, way north in Quebec. And Mo may have turned to somebody, may have made a remark, and people started laughing. Most of them were French. The gallery, we probably had a couple of hundred people. So he just sat down on the green on two and waited for everybody to get quiet before he played his next shot. But he sat down and didn't move for about 5 minutes. I says, Mo, we got to go. There's people behind us. You know, I says, they like you. They're nice people. And I like the French people. They're animated, you know, and I got along pretty well with them.
I always enjoyed playing up there in Quebec.
Yeah, everybody, because they're so outgoing, you know. They like their stuff. They're great fans. I have to say that, John, because I'm originally a Montrealer.
Right. That's what. Now there were some great Quebec players like Jock Smith, right?
Here's a Jock Smith story. Jock Smith came to this country, I guess, just before the war. He worked for the Hydro in Quebec 2 weeks of the year, and this was when I was a caddy. 14, 15, 16, I would have to find him a golf ball to play now and then. Anyway, Jock, the course that we grew up on was par 73. Jock would play 2 weeks of the year, and that was it. He wouldn't play other than his holidays. His first round may have been 73 or 74, but other than that, he was in the 60s. Par 73, and he was a poor putter. R73. Some of them were short par 3s because back then, by rule, if it's over 450, it's a par 5. But I can recall our longest hole, it was a 16. His driver was a Spalding driver, no insert. Persimmon head, no insert. He would hit 16 with a drive and a 3-4 iron, 5-5-5. The 17th was 300 yards, and he would put a little bit of wet mud on his club face so it wouldn't go over the green. It's 300 yards, so he didn't want to hit it over the green. Now, that's 45-46. Now, we're at Summerlee this one day. It's kind of a drizzly day. The seventh hole is about 225, 230, par 3. And I'm out there with him, and I'm caddying because I'm addicted to golf, good players. And he plays this hole, and his 3 irons at the back of the green, it's all flight, by the way. His ball was higher than Jack Nicklaus's flight.
Wow.
He was all about 155 pounds, 5'10", 5'11", not a strong man, but wiry strong forearms and wrists. Now, we played 6 years later. We played the Labatt Open in 1953 at the same golf course at Summerlee. I'm playing with DeMarit, Dickinson, and where you're hitting 3 woods, 4 woods, and 5 woods on that same hole that Jock Smith hit it. And now I could hit it. I'm 23 years of age. I can hit it then. We're using wooden clubs to fly it 230 yards. Jock Smith did it with a 3-iron.
Wow. So he had tremendous hand speed, it sounds like.
Hey, he did.
Yeah.
Had a lot of width, wide open stance.
He had a wide stance.
Had a wide stance, like wide like Mo, open.
Mm-hmm.
And quite a little bit of lateral on the way back. Never took a divot, but a marvelous player. Poor putter for a man that could hit the ball so well. I can recall, even when I hit it pretty good, I started back at Mount Royal. I started teaching there in 1950. Now, our fifth hole was about 195, 200 yards. Now, I was still, you know, maybe I'd hit a 2 or 3 iron out of the green. Jock Smith was just a little 5-iron shot for him, you know. So he was good. I mean, in my eye, may have seen a big man when I was 14, 15, 16, but when I was 20, 21, you know, my eye is a little different. I've got a different appreciation for distance, I think. You know, like, I should be able to hit it as far as Jock could because I'm at it every day. But no, I couldn't. So there's a man, 155 pounds, 5'10", could really, really play. And no one's ever heard of Jock Smith, of course. Paul has.
Yeah. Well, there's, you know, I noticed when I was playing out on tour, no matter where I went, there was always somebody that I'd never heard of that could just go out and shoot 64s.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, sure. Yeah, like, you know, there's a lot of good, you know, people talk about all the great, the leap, you come up with, you mentioned Melhorn?
Yeah, Bill Melhorn.
Okay, Bill Melhorn, not too many people would know what that is, but that was one of the greats. Another one that I liked was, because Hogan wasn't around, but Lloyd Mangrum was around.
Yeah.
Now, Lloyd, I liked Lloyd a lot, and he could really plumb out play. But he doesn't get the accolades that some of the other guys are getting.
Yeah, and you mentioned Kai LaFoon as well.
Well, he was a character.
Yeah?
Yeah. I mentioned Kai only because it was my first time at bat at the Canadian Open. The last time I played the Canadian Open was 68, and my draw was Bolt and Littler.
Oh, that's a great group.
Nice draw?
Yeah. Yeah, Bolt and Littler.
Yeah, you couldn't get two better swingers.
Yeah, that's. Do you feel that the players were better? Let's say better ball strikers in the old days than they are now.
I think that they're more artistic. They look better.
We sure see the modern players missing a lot of fairways, you know, and.
It's either the equipment or the posture or the swing is wrong, you know. There's something missing. They don't look, as a whole, I could possibly, you know, pull out about 20 to 30 names and say, these guys all swing better than modern 30 guys. You know, like, even the winner yesterday missed fairways by a long...
Well, how about two weeks ago, Anthony Kim won on the tour, and he was dead last in driving accuracy for the week.
there you go.
Now, could that possibly have happened in the old days?
I don't think so.
I mean, you couldn't finish dead last in driving accuracy on the old tour and win a tournament.
No.
Because the courses were tighter. You had trees, they were tight.
Yeah.
Now the courses are a lot more wide open. The rough isn't as high. The greens are perfect. It's much more of a putting game, it seems.
It's more putting than anything else, really.
I think in the old days, you know, when the greens weren't as good, you know, you had to just pepper the flag all day long to, you know, you kept hitting it around the pin, you're going to knock in a few putts. But you couldn't just rely on that all the time.
You got it, John.
Yeah.
I don't like to say this, that we look better back in the 40s and 50s and 60s than they do in the 2000s, but it shows up like walking with and playing with Tommy Bow. I've never seen him anywhere near Tiger's position on the finish, you know, in my memory. Like, Bow was solid, rock, perfect on the finish, and Tiger's all over the place. Now, here's world number one, looks like a dub on the finish. He's a club thrower. No, he was a marvelous golfer. Hogan thought he was the best ball striker.
Well, certainly George Knutson was very big on the finish. He really believed in finishing flat on the left foot and in having an abbreviated finish.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. He was solid on the finish. There's no question about it.
I think Tiger looks pretty solid with his shorter iron.
He should have a driver in his hand anyway.
Yeah. Yeah, for the number one player in the world to, you know, be down, he's usually around 140th in driving accuracy, that sort of thing on the tour. It's surprising that the golf courses, that the tour really allows that, the way they have the courses set up. I feel there should be an emphasis on driving accuracy in the game, and that's missing.
Yeah, I would think so.
Yeah.
And of course, par fives today are fourths for most of them.
Well, they really are. Like Paul was saying, I mean, the tour guys are playing par 68s every week.
Yeah.
So in my mind, when I see a guy shoot 16 under, he's basically shooting even par in the old days.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And we used to have to hit 3 shots to a 5 par.
Yeah, and if you did reach the green on a par 5, it was a risky shot, right? It was a fairway wood or a long iron.
Downwind with a fast fairway.
To a treacherous green, maybe some hazard around it. I mean, it was a real risk, and that was one of the beauties of the game back then, was you had a real risk and reward situation for going for a par 5. Whereas now, you know, a guy's hitting an 8 iron in or a 6 iron for a second shot, it's not very dramatic.
That's a mistake.
Yeah. I think, you know, the USGA and the RNA really went wrong at some point with the equipment. They probably should have just stuck with persimmon, and that would have put an end to it. Had it stayed persimmon, even, you know, in the late 70s, I think they first came out with the metal woods, right?
Yeah.
But had it stayed persimmon, like baseball has stayed with the wooden bats, and, you know, cricket, I think, is still hitting the wooden bats.
Yeah.
Golf kind of lost its way, I think, a little bit there. And,
I think so, that people got greedy.
Yeah.
Yeah, they're, the rules and regulations, you know, should have been enforced a little more. Yeah. That's not acceptable.
Speaking of rules, now, back in the early 60s, they toyed with the out-of-bounds being a one-stroke penalty. Do you remember that?
Yeah, briefly.
It was for maybe a couple years, right?
Yeah. Yeah, it was in and out.
In and out, right. Now, you won the Ontario PGA Seniors, right? Your first
couple? I won the Ontario Seniors, 3 years in a row.
Yeah, can you tell us a little bit about that?
John.
Well, we want to hear that. I mean, this is, you know.
Let's see. I think Mo was in the field maybe 2 or 3 of the years. It was 1980-81. I could still get the ball out there pretty good. You know, I pretty close to reaching fives and two and all that sort of stuff. Iron play was pretty good. The nerves on the green were all right. Yeah, I think, you know, the scores were around 71. And I guess, you know, I was kind of fortunate to have it happen. I didn't, you know, like, it happens once a year, you don't think about it, and then sometime in the future, I did that 3 years in a row. Isn't that something? Anyway, it was all right. I missed winning the Canadian a couple of times. I didn't spend a whole lot of time on my game because I was a club pro per se, you know. That was me being a club pro, trying to play a little bit of golf now and then. And it used to be fashionable in the 30s, in the 40s, and the 50s. Then it changed in the 60s, I think.
Do you have any recollections of Sam Snead?
I was either in front of him or behind him, but never drawn with him. He was in front of us in 68 at St. George's. I watched Sam put on an exhibition at my club. I was a junior at Malva in Montreal, put on an exhibition there, and that was about 1947-48. I watched Sam play in the Pro-Am at Seminole because Hogan was there. That was 51. I played with Sam in the field. Sam, marvelous storyteller, by the way. Did you know that, John?
Yeah, that's what Al Barkow would talk about. Yeah.
A great storyteller. And he'd have you in stitches. And a great athlete, of course. I can remember playing in 1982. We had a kind of a side event. The chairman of the event would have a chairman's day, and we were playing. The tournament was at St. Charles that year. The Peter Jackson was, but the chairman's day was at Niagara. Well, I happened to be in, you know, like one of the group of 15 select, I guess, for some reason. I don't know why. Because I was nice to his wife, or said hello to his wife. I don't know. Anyway, Wilmot Tennyson was the chairman, and a great, great guy. He was chairman of the Canadian Open after that. Snead was in the field. I can always say, well, I beat Snead because I was low that day in the chairman's day.
Now, did you have the course record there at Brampton?
I think Balling may have had it. I was going to have it, but I three-putted 18 for 64, I think. I think Balling made 63 there once.
You know, a lot of those old course records that were shot back in the 50s and 60s still stand today.
Oh, yeah, I would think so.
Yeah.
Mo has most of the records in Canada. He didn't strike the ball that well, but then he played a lot.
Yeah.
Mo played a lot of amateur golf before he played pro. Paul asked me, when did Mo turn pro? I think Mo and I played the final round of Payne Open 57 at Westmount, Kitchener, and he was still an amateur then. So 58 must have been the first year he was pro.
So you played the PGA Tour in the 50s?
I played, started in 53 in Phoenix. We had a tournament here in Canada called the Bursary, B&A Bursary. The three winners got to go onto the tour, and the first stop was, it was a 10-week deal or something on the tour, and we started in Phoenix.
Can you tell me a little bit about your recollections of Alvy Thompson? I took a lesson from Alvy Thompson.
Alvy was a great student of the game.
Great putter.
Oh, marvelous putter. Just a marvelous putter.
Has some interesting theories on putting, you know, he shared with me.
Yeah, he was a great putter. Yeah, I kind of missed Alvy when he moved away from here and went back to Vancouver.
A lot of good
players. You know all these guys. John?
Well, I played the Canadian Tour for 7 years, so I got to, if I didn't meet these guys, I got to hear stories about them from guys like Jerry Anderson. And
you know, I enjoy you doing what you're doing, and if I've added to your bag of tricks, now the only thing is, there's a lot of people in the world that don't know much about Canada as golfers. The only thing that I'm sad about is that there's more South Africans on the tour than there are Canadians. Because, you know, Canada is much closer to the United States than South Africa.
Yeah, yeah.
And it bewilders me. When we played in the 50s, we may have had 8 to 10 Canadians play the tour in the wintertime.
Well, you have a short season, you know, a shorter season up there where the guys in the States and the South can play all year.
You can always go south and play.
Yeah, yeah. And that's what you guys would always go down to Florida, right?
Yeah, right on.
And I know George used to go down to Florida and practice.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, and I think there was a story I read about George and Alvy watching Hogan at Seminole, like peeking through the trees or something, and watching him practice down one of the fairways while they're kept getting chased off the course by the security.
Yeah. Well, we were, you know, it was we were on Seminole, and we parked in the parking lot. It was all right because it was the member guest or the pro-am, and public was welcome. This one particular day, I don't know what George was doing there. I guess it was, you know, if it's members only, guests aren't allowed out on the property. In the pro-am, I think you're allowed. We were permitted on, with our PGA cards.
One of the questions I wanted to ask you, it seems like with the old timers that I've talked to, there was a kind of an aura of secrecy about the golf swing a lot. Like, people weren't really that interested in telling their secrets, you know, so much. I mean, you hear about Hogan's secret and, you know, other players claim to have had, you know, secrets, but it seemed like maybe it was very competitive back then, to where, you know, you wouldn't go around telling everybody, you know, even in a book or an instruction book you were writing, you know, nobody was giving away their information.
That's possible. I just ran around the countryside looking for the best that I could see, and if they were close by and I was able to watch, that's why I hung my hat on this Jock Smith, because I like him hitting the ball so well and scoring so well. I want to see how it was done. And I walked around with Snead when he played a practice round an exhibition at Marlborough in Montreal. I dogged him and watched him. And so what I did is I didn't ask too many people about the golf swing, because I don't have a large frame, so, you know, my eyes did most of my learning.
Mm-hmm.
So it was easy for me to mimic any of these swings, you know, being short, little, not heavy, you know, and all that sort of stuff.
Hogan wasn't a real big guy, and Gene Sarazen wasn't real big either.
Okay, I'll leave you with one. I played with a guy that won the first Masters. Who's that?
Horton Smith.
Good for you. I played with the guy who won the second Masters. Who's that?
Gene Sarazen.
Sarazen with his double eagle.
34, right?
Yeah. 34 for Horton Smith, 35 for Sarazen.
35 was Sarazen's. His shot heard around the world.
Yeah. There you go.
Well, that's great. Well, that's wonderful.
Yeah. And I played with Horton twice in the same year. Texas Open, and the next time was at Greensboro in Carolina.
What did you remember about Horton Smith?
Horton Smith was a very nice gentleman, very pleasant, nice, relaxed swing, a nice person. Our threesome, we helped a guy win the Texas Open. Our third was Chandler Harper. It was 1954. Chandler Harper's 40, front nine. Everybody's eating the golf course. Chandler Harper's out in 40, and it's a cold, cold day. He says, guys, nine holes enough for me. I'm on my way to Florida. Horton and I talk. Chandler and I go in the back nine. He shoots 30 in the back nine, and then he plays the second day, goes 63, 63, 63, and wins the tournament.
Wow.
It's in the record book.
Three
63s. Open with 40. And everybody's shooting 62, 63, 64. And Chandler knows this. He knows he's at least 10 shots off the pace after nine holes. And he says, and it's cold. And I said, I can't blame him. I said, let's finish the back nine. And he shoots 30 in the back nine. And then goes 63, 63, 63. Texas Open at Breckenridge Park.
It must have been hitting the ball pretty good, because the greens probably weren't all that perfect back then.
No, they're not perfect. He wasn't a long hitter. He's a marvelous putter, though. Wooden shafted blade putter. John, good talking to you. I gotta go and feed Mama now.
Okay, well, thank you so much.
John, you know, the way you're teaching, you can't have your back horizontal to the ground, nor can you have it vertical to the ground. Somewhere in between, the guy's gotta be able to move. And those guys that are playing today, some of them can't swing any good.
Yeah, I agree with you on that. I don't play a lot now. I maybe play once a week if I'm lucky, but it disappoints me when I watch the PGA Tour and I see guys, you know, spraying it all over the course, and I think, you know, I don't even play and I could hit the ball better than that. I mean, I can't putt like these guys do, but
exactly.
As far as the striking of the ball, I mean, I'm not really impressed, and I'm a bit disappointed that we're not seeing another Hogan or another Knutson.
You can't help your students by pulling in these tour players now. You got to go, you know, between Harry Vardon, Bobby Jones, Hogan, and some of the good swings of the past. Mel Horns is one, Tommy Bolts another one, you and I.
Yeah, that's right. Great.
Paul asked me, hey, Dad, how do I get rid of this buddy slice? I says, there's the range right over there. Go and figure it out.
Go and figure it out. Dig it out of the dirt,
and
right?
When he figured it out, he owned it. If I told him, he would have borrowed it.
Ah, I gotcha.
Got it?
Yep. Yeah, I just wanted to ask you real quick, you know, you guys used to not use yardages and play all by feel and sight, I wanted to get your thoughts on that.
I guess we did it instinctively, you know, doing it so long, John, that yardage books and caddies walking off never occurred to us. Didn't rely on our caddy to help us play. I guess we were, you know, more animalistic, or we had more of a sixth sense about it all.
An intuition.
Intuition is a good word. You know, if you played the hole once, you got it memorized, and if the wind is blowing or what have you, or the pin is over here, and you learned to measure it, we knew where the ball was going to land, you know, before we hit the goddamn thing.
So when you would play a practice round at a course, you would hit a couple different shots into the greens and just try and get a feel for what you're going to...
Practice sessions were nine-hole power nines. We would have 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 guys. We're going down playing skins after our first, initial practice round. If the practice field isn't available or there's no practice field, we would play an extra 9 holes and play skins. And... We're aiming to make a 1 or a 2 on a hole to get a skin. I mean, it came to us from a different sense, you know, not from a yardage book, or it was more of necessity that we hit the ball and know that it's going to land where it's supposed to land.
They would have yardages on the tee box, like you would know how long the hole was, right?
Oh yeah.
And would there be a 150 tree out there, something like that? No. There was nothing. It was just you kind of knew how long the hole was.
Yeah,
and then,
exactly.
So if it was a 440-yard par 4, you knew you were going to be hitting a 2 or 3 iron.
Yeah.
You knew
that you could visually measure 200 yards, 150 yards, or whatever. And I guess because of the structure of the greens today, some of them are more undulating. Ours, I guess, may have been a little flatter or easier to read from a distance. But we knew... I think we knew where the ball was going to land, John, before we hit it.
Yeah, that makes sense. I've always felt like if you're not using yardages, it requires you to get a little more in tune with your surroundings and the wind and the lie and all these sorts of things, and you start relying on your own intuition more than just relying on the book.
Yeah, I mean, if you have to rely on the book, then you're not sure of your swing. I think we knew where the ball was going to end up.
When I was on tour, you know, I used the yardage books, and now I never use a yardage book, and I find that my distance control is surprisingly good, if not better than when I was playing on tour using yardage books.
Yeah, well, you're relying on the math, and not your golf swing.
Yeah.
You know, like this swing is 165 yards. Bullshit. It's what it is. It's a sense, you know, that if you swing at it and you want to go X number of yards, that's where it's going to go. And but if you're going by the book and you miss it by, you know, you miss it with the yardage book and the caddy and caddies, and now you don't know whether your swing's working.
Because there's a lot of different ways to hit a 160-yard shot. I mean, you can, if you're going to cut it in,
you might need an extra club. Exactly. If you're going to draw it in, are you going to hit it low, or are you going to run it up? I mean, it's all these elements, right?
Yeah. Was it some guy once asked Hogan, how far, what do you use for 150 yards? Hogan hit three balls, one with an 8-iron, one with a 7-iron, one with a 6-iron. He says, I hit any one of those for 150 yards.
Yeah, that makes sense to me. I mean,
you know, like, and the balls are all in the same spot.
Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah, I thank you for getting your insights on that from a, you know, traditional player, because I think that's something that's really been lost in the modern game.
Yeah.
I mean, but now they're using laser scopes.
Oh, give me a break.
So.
Okay, John, good talking to you.
Okay, great talking to you, John. Okay. Thank you.
And that finishes up our interview with Canadian former PGA Tour player John Henrik, winner of the Quebec Open and three-time Ontario Seniors Champion. We'll have more stuff coming your way in the months to come at advancedballstriking.com. Hope you enjoyed.